Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Big Changes in Healthcare, New Regulations and New Diagnostics Players Poised to Reshape Lab Testing. The presenter is Lael White, Executive Chair and CEO, SheFin, Inc., San Diego, California.
Welcome to the 29th Executive War College. We're so pleased to have you here again. After all these years, we know we have a lot of first-timers, but also a lot of people who've been here, I guess, all 29 years, which is remarkable, and we really thank you for that. So before we get to the important part, I've got a few announcements I'll make here. First off, anyone interested in a giant pickleball tournament on Friday? No, just kidding. I hope you enjoyed that giveaway. I'm going to tell you, we just found from registration that this is going to be the first Executive War College that has over 1,000 attendees at it. So thank you very much for that. So a few housekeeping notes before we get the real speakers up here. We want to have a special thanks right now to all our corporate benefactors, our partners. We couldn't do this event without them. They include Clinisys, Coronis, Data Innovations, LK, Esperion Health, Grace Health Technologies, Leica Biosystems, Optum, Quadax, Synergen, Telcor, US Health Tech, and Xiphon. So thank you very much to those folks for all their support. The usual, right? What's the question we get asked the most? Where are the restrooms? Out to the left. And also, of course, goes without saying, silence anything that makes a noise during the presentations. I won't say beepers because I think that's so 80s, and I'll tell my age by saying that. So cell phones, anything that makes noise, please put it on silent mode. So now gives me great pleasure to introduce the founder and the man behind the Executive War College for the 29th time, my boss, Robert Michel.
Thank you, sir. How are all y'all this morning? That's our Texas greeting, you know, in the plural. I want to thank you all for this support. It's very gratifying. We work very hard to put on a relevant program for you. And we have a tradition at the Executive War College that we start the first day. I'm going to ask you all to stand up in a moment, and I want you to turn around, and I want you to introduce yourself to someone you've never met before. And I'd like the two of you to share something innovative and clever that you're doing in your lab organization. Okay? So go ahead, stand up, shake hands with someone you've never met before. Okay, let's come to order. Let's finish up that conversation and come to order. Yes, take your seats. Okay, let's come to order. All right. Now, your assignment is to find this person somewhere again, today or tomorrow, and continue this conversation. And the reason we do this is one of the powerful benefits of any conference is the networking. So we've just helped you expand your network by one or two folks. Quick question. How many of you, is this your first ever Executive War College? Raise your hand. Look around the room. Okay. It shows you that this is still a very dynamic and growing segment of healthcare. Now, it's my privilege normally to open the War College and give you all a bit of Robert's take on what's happening in healthcare and with lab medicine and the lab marketplace. We're going to do that this afternoon in our closing general session because it's my pleasure to introduce you now to Lael White, who's the CEO of Xiphon. And she is a very keen strategist. She's going to share with you the lay of the land, and she'll also participate in the panel discussion that'll close today's general session. So let's give Lila White of Zifin a very warm War College welcome. Okay, have at it.
Hello, everyone. It's great to be here at the 29th Executive War College, and I think I've been at most of them. So it's really a pleasure. Robert and team continue to bring some of the most thought-provoking agenda to our audience, and always of great interest to everyone in the lab industry, some of the things that he has to let us know about. And, of course, things as usual are escalating in the lab industry. We never seem to have any kind of lull. It's like time and time again we have new things cropping up, and despite the fact that the share of wallet for labs has been increasing in overall healthcare costs, we still have a lot of footwork to be done in our industry. We don't have enough access to consumers, and that consumer education is becoming more and more important. And, of course, could AI be the answer to that? Potentially. I think, in addition to that, the lab industry and what labs do have changed quite a bit over the years. We've changed from really an industry that provides diagnosing a disease based on observations into a lab industry that really thrives on discovery, maintenance, and preventative maintenance specifically, with the technology changes that have really accelerated genetic testing. We see that now we're at a point where consumers are very aware of laboratory tests and how it will help their lifestyle in general to improve their health and understand really what they need to do. So over the decades, I think these changes in labs and this consumer relationship can be advanced even further. And I think a lot of that can happen through access and technology. I think that the labs provide services that are not just a commodity. We are actually in the practice of medicine. As fast as things are changing, physicians only get about one semester of laboratory training in their medical training. And essentially after that, it becomes almost obsolete. The environment is changing so rapidly. It's up to laboratorians to keep in touch with physicians and the provider community and inform them of the changes and the innovations that are happening in the lab arena. As we know, the holy grail for lab is decision support at two points in the process of rendering services. The first point is at the time of order. Labs really want the patient to get the best test at the right time under the right circumstances, and there's a decision support point at that point. And the second point is at the time that the results are delivered. Again, a decision point for the therapy decision for the physician. Those two decision points are critical, and they change the entire healthcare structure of how physician or patients are treated. Essentially, AI could be a future solution to that as well. We've certainly tried in the industry many times to do utilization tables and really teach the physician and the providers how to order, when to order. But essentially, a lot of that utilization is based on standards of care. Standards of care are about 4 to 5 years behind innovation, as you know. And essentially, they're not necessarily optimizing the test. Some of those decisions are even financially based. Is the test reimbursable? Is it covered? And essentially, for the best healthcare to happen, we really need to optimize the test that's ordered. Not reduce tests ordered, but really optimize the right test at the right time and then move on to the right therapy decision. And if we did that, laboratory diagnostics really has the potential to change the economics of healthcare to the greatest extent by really gaining efficiencies in healthcare and at the same time highly improving outcomes. And so from that perspective, the lab has a pretty big role in the practice of medicine to deliver the types of innovation that are needed to move the healthcare forward and to also move the economics in the right direction as well. As we saw with PAMA, some of the reimbursement compression that we've had over the years really impacted the capacity of labs. And during the pandemic, we saw that come to fruition where it was really hard to come up to speed. If it weren't for the cash infusion from the government during the pandemic, labs could not have come up to capacity quickly enough to handle some of the testing that was performed. And even as that happened, the rush to build capacity really caused a fairly significant supply chain issue. Now we have the FDA LDT rules just announced yesterday looming over our head as another structural change in laboratory that can actually supersede the impact that PAMA had on the lab business. And essentially, I think what we can see with PAMA is that and then cash infusion might have been able to correct the system a little bit. But if we lose innovation in the laboratory industry, we will not be able to fix that with just a cash infusion. We will have lost quite a bit. Years of education, job experience, and community knowledge allows laboratories to really develop essential lab tests that facilitate diagnostic needs in a rapidly changing environment. This crucial national network of talent, experience, expertise, vertical integration with physicians in assisting them to understand how to use laboratory services provides the most dynamic diagnostic innovation, not just in the U.S., but in the world, and it should be preserved. So having said all that, I want to kind of move to an understanding of the economics in healthcare right now and what's impacting us. Obviously, the FDA thing and PAMA are large impacts. We have to continue to try and pass the SALSA legislation, which corrects some of the PAMA implementation issues that happened that really gave us a big pricing problem. And at the same time, we need to work on the FDA piece and the valid legislation potentially to really now see how we move forward with LDTs. So the dynamics of healthcare. You can see two graphs here that show you some of the major changes in our industry that are going to impact us. After the pandemic, we had kind of a rise in chronic disease diagnosis, primarily in the cancer cardiac arena. And we saw quite a bit of healthcare costs going up as a result of that. And, of course, we have a senior population that's growing very rapidly. 95% of most seniors have one chronic condition, and 80% have over two chronic conditions. And that's the most costly part of the insurance and Medicare programs. You can see with the top graph that about a decade ago, the number of working adults to seniors was 4-to-1. Today it's 3-to-1. And in the next decade, it'll be 2-to-1. So you can see why the Medicare Trust Fund is talking about running out of money by the year 2031. The bottom graph shows you the percentage of GDP that we use on healthcare. In the 60s, it used to be about 5%, and within the next 10 years, it will grow to approximately 20%. So we have increasing healthcare costs, a reduction of funding of healthcare, and we have a shortage of doctors, specialists, and nurses, also raising labor costs. Hospitals were operating previously in the last decade, the costs and operating losses of almost 23% of hospitals had operating losses, and today it's close to 53%. And so you can see why there's a lot of consolidation in the hospital industry and a lot of selling of ancillary services like laboratories. You see a lot of mergers and acquisitions happening in that arena for that reason. Consumer-driven demand and all of the companies that have gone into the healthcare industry have taken away some of the most lucrative profit centers from the health systems. And as a result of that, they are also creating new strategies to bring services closer to the consumer. Consumer demand is based on cost, and they have higher deductibles, higher coinsurance, and convenience and quality. And people like to get their health care closer to where they reside now, and health systems are in a different position of how they service patients. So we see that Medicare outlays, which were at about $744 billion in 22, will be increasing to over $1.7 trillion by the year 2035. And it's no wonder, then, that both at the federal and at the state level, we've seen a shift of Medicare beneficiaries and Medicaid beneficiaries to Advantage programs and MCOs, a fairly significant shift because it's less costlier than the fee-for-service Medicare program. And for the first time this year, the government, CMS, has introduced a three-year risk adjustment, lowering, actually, for the first time, the amount that the insurers are reimbursed for these Advantage patients. And next year, there'll be another reduction. At the same time, they've also adjusted the star ratings, resulting in lower bonuses to the insurers. So as you might guess, repercussions of that will likely be, at some point, a reduction in benefits, maybe an increase in rates to mitigate some of the impact of this to the insurers. And, of course, it will probably include an increase in the criteria used for pre-authorizations that have impacted us very significantly in the industry, another thing that the industry needs to continue to worry about. So if we move on to the next screen, we see that there's a lot of disruptors in the laboratory industry and in healthcare in general. A lot of the consumer-oriented companies, whether they're consumer-oriented technology companies or consumer-oriented payers or consumer-oriented pharmacy chains, have gotten into the healthcare fray in a fairly big way. And they have a lot of money to experiment, and they have been experimenting quite a bit, opening clinics, closing clinics, making decisions on telehealth one way or another. And we see that, just they're a petri dish of experimentation that we can look at to see the direction healthcare is taking. But the one thing to note, which is really important, is that consumers are driving this, and consumers want their healthcare in various disparate entities, not just in a vertical health system, but across the board where it's more convenient for them and where there is specialty integration, vertical integration. And for that reason, we have to be ready as an industry to provide the technology infrastructure to give them the results and the medical information they need at the time they need it. So it's really important to understand that there's a technology infrastructure that needs to be incorporated into the strategy of every single provider that allows the consumer to direct their information. Of course, the genetic testing piece also has shifted the way we practice medicine to a more personalized medicine. And again, that means that things that are siloed in various entities need to come together, and that data needs to come together in order to provide the patient's information to the provider needed at the time it is needed. And so that's an important change that's happening that really allows us to optimize the way we practice healthcare. So let's talk a little bit about why this impact is happening and how it's happening. The rate of the Advantage program growth is fairly significant. As of today, almost 51% of patients are in an Advantage Medicare Advantage program, and it will be about 62% in another 10 years or so. We can see that the top payers, and some of the slides are not showing all the data I see, but the top payers in this are United Healthcare, Cigna, Aetna, Humana, as you might guess, for the Medicare program. The Medicaid MCO growth and the Advantage program growth is much more rapid than Medicare. And at this time, over 90% in most states are in an Advantage program or an MCO. Same players. Again, you see Humana there. You'll see Cigna, United Healthcare, big time. But also regionally, a lot of the blues have a lot of these Advantage programs. What does that mean to us? It means a huge increase in prior authorization. So let's take a little bit of a look at denials and what's happening to denials in our industry. So you'll see that the dark blue line is the Advantage programs, and the top gray line on both of these graphs is Medicare fee-for-service. So Medicare fee-for-service, if you look at the top graph, those are all claims, and we're looking at a little over 10 million clean claims. These are clean, payable claims, not ones with errors on them that are submitted to these payers. Medicare is paying around 98% of clean claims. Only a few, 2% approximately, or a little bit higher, require additional information. But if you look at the Advantage programs for all claims, you'll see that they are somewhere between 85%, in the 85% arena on the average, some lower, some higher. And the bottom graph is limited coverage tests. So with limited coverage tests, you see Medicare paying 95% approximately of those fee-for-service, while you see that the Advantage payers range somewhere between 75 and 85% of clean claims. But the more interesting part of this is the way these claims are denied. If you look at the Medicare program, the majority, almost 55%, are denied for medical necessity or requiring additional documentation or clarification of information provided, something of that nature, fairly standard, fairly straightforward. If you look at the Advantage programs, the denials are all over the board. Only about 15% are denied for medical necessity, another 15% for service not covered, another 15% for diagnosis not applicable to disease, even though they may be specific to the limited coverage criteria already set by the MACs. And then there are dozens of other denials coming through, making it so much harder for us to work these claims properly, causing a lot of appeals, very costly appeals, to get paid. So I think what you'll see, and this is kind of a top-line graph here of the same type of thing by Advantage Plan. And the Advantage Plans are at the top. The MACs are at the bottom. Again, you can see a comparison of the claims that are being paid that are limited coverage in the green and the overall claims in the blue. You can see that the MACs are paying obviously much, much better than the Advantage Plans. And that second plan that pays only about 50% is actually Kaiser. So this is kind of the roadmap of how the denials are being handled today and why we have to spend so much time on prior authorization rules. And we have spent quite a bit of time on that. CMS has clarified those rules quite a bit, but they look to us, the industry, to provide them with additional data. And this data is very important in their thinking because they want to make sure that the patients, the beneficiaries in the Advantage program don't lose access. That is a key element of what CMS wants to see. So it is kind of up to us as the industry to demonstrate that they are actually losing access if we want changes to prior authorization. Furthermore, I think on top of this, what we do see also is that, you know, these denial rates and the cost is, again, very significant to us. We have to deal with all of that in terms of the data that we bring back. And we see that a lot of providers, in fact, because of the administrative burden, abandon ordering a test almost 50% of the time, even before it gets to the lab. This isn't even documented by the lab industry, but it's documented in a number of surveys that are done with physicians of whether they proceed with prior authorization requirements or abandon services. So these are all things that we need to be very aware of and keep track of as an industry. So there's a lot of middlemen in healthcare. In the pharmaceutical industry, the pharmacy benefits managers have been around for a long time, and they're the usual, a lot of the payers have actually acquired the major PBMs. So Aetna owns a PBM, Cigna, Optum, they all own the biggest PBMs. And these benefits managers really work on formularies and really trying to get generic drugs used instead of the trademark drugs. And so that's been a big piece of what they do. But also, they have done a lot of pricing kind of strategies that have been fairly significant and have caused a lot of money to be taken out of the system from providers going directly to the PBMs. And they don't have enough pricing transparency. As a result, there's quite a bit of pending legislation on this. And then you have disruptors like Cost Plus, Mark Cuban's Cost Plus, that is coming into the fray and saying PBMs are making too much money. We need to cut some of these middlemen out of here in order to get the money back to the providers. We now see a lot of lab benefit managers moving into the laboratory business, so something to keep an eye on. Avalon, Optum, Evercore. And so we see some of these items moving in. But at the same time, the Palmetto's MolDX program, which we're all familiar with because of Medicare, is bringing some standardization in coverage to the fray, which is quite welcome, and moving into the commercial insurance business as well. So PAMA, what's the impact of PAMA? I'm going to show you here on this graph that a lot of the payers, United Healthcare, Cigna, and Aetna are displayed here in the three bars, are paying at a rate that's interestingly much lower than the Medicare clinical lab fee schedule, which is in the green bar at the top. The orange bar at the bottom is the average that these payers are paying in the industry for contracted rates. And what we see here is that once the PAMA original set of data was established, and these are the top 20 tests, by the way, that were in the original PAMA set that they deemed as being almost 80% of the reimbursement. So what we see here is once the PAMA data set had been established and the mean was established, the commercial payers went straight to the mean with their contracted pricing, while the clinical lab fee schedule, we only got 2 years of cuts because of the pandemic. The third year of cut never happened for us in the lab industry for Medicare. And, of course, that's still pending, and as SALSA is correcting some of the administrative change to the way PAMA is implemented, we still don't necessarily have full market pricing. And you can see why. We never really had full market pricing to begin with because the private payers have always followed the Medicare fee schedule. And even though a lot of labs have negotiated the fee schedule away from their, as a percentage of Medicare, away from their contracts, the payers are still looking at the clinical lab fee schedule in order to develop their contracted rates. So Again, it's really important to note that aside from newly introduced tests, most tests that have been around a long time don't really have a market price. And this exercise continues to be, even with the correction, welcome correction of SALSA, this kind of pricing in PAMA continues to drive pricing down in our industry. So next on our list is the FDA LDT thing. So genetic tests have been introduced pretty rapidly over the years. It's the fastest growing segment of the laboratory market. And what we can see from this graph in the light blue is the molecular diagnostic testing is growing the fastest in terms of the number of LDTs that are introduced. So immunoassays and molecular diagnostics are the fastest growing. A lot of labs have been surveyed over the time. ARUP did a fantastic survey and found that almost 91% of respondents say that they would not continue with a lot of their LDTs once the FDA regulations came into play, and that that would curb a lot of innovation of LDTs. So even though the FDA timeline is about 4 years, I think what we will see during this four-year time period is a lot of changes and potentially some legislative changes, maybe with the Valid Act, maybe new introduced legislation. There will be a lot of discussion about that today. But essentially, there will probably be some lawsuits filed by the industry as to whether FDA even has the authority to do the rulemaking that they're currently doing. And we will eventually come to some kind of conclusion, but labs have to be prepared at any rate for a change in this arena. And so finally, I leave you with two thoughts. One is technology has to be the focus. AI has to be a focus. We need to gain efficiencies in our industry that reduce costs through technology, and we need to have patient centricity to accommodate the new healthcare that is being designed in a way that disparate health systems have to be able to have the information they need to properly assess the patient. Innovation and comprehensive AI are critical. Everybody should be looking at that, and your database infrastructure that supports AI is essential to this exercise. Interoperability and security, obviously high on our minds because of the change incident, a cybersecurity incident that just happened. It's really important to understand that no matter what we do, security has to be a piece of this with PHI and the types of information that we deal with. And finally, get involved. I think this is the key factor, I have to say. We've always had a small voice in our industry because our small share of wallet. But essentially, we have to educate. We have to use traditional and social media to get our message across to the overall general public, who are now very interested in their healthcare and very interested in cost and very interested in laboratory diagnostics and how it shapes their future. We have to get involved. We have to partner with other delivery systems, whether they be the local pharmacy chain or the telehealth organization or the health system. We have to partner with all of these. We have to join associations, be extremely vocal, collect data. Labs and IVD manufacturers have a lot more in common than apart, even though they may not agree on the FDA thing. The labs are the innovators that actually they're the engine that grows the IVD manufacturer's test kits. So essentially, there are a lot of reasons why we should be working together. We need to promote the role of the healthcare no matter what we do, and inject your expertise as laboratorians and professionals into the discussion and make sure that we are heard. So I think that's probably the biggest message I can deliver to everyone, and I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Hang on just a minute. Well, Lila's going to be part of the panel in this session, so we'll save our questions for then. But I want to say thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was well done. No, you can.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.